the about 900 species have actually a protorsis that looks like that. You could assume that probably a pretty large part or a pretty large number of these Amazini actually live in spider webs. Then another group are the antlering holoptilini or feather-legged bugs. They're feeding on ants, and at least part of them have a pretty cool specialized structure that's called a trichome that helps them to get a hold of these ants. Then further there, for example, the Echecodiini. It's another pretty large group, more than 600 species, and there's scattered but also increasing evidence that probably all of them actually feed on millipedes, which obviously makes you wonder how they manage to get around the defensive glands of millipedes, for example, cyanide glands. And then finally, there is Cyavatini. This is an immature. The immature is camouflage, and on the right, it's one of the camouflaging structures. And they hang out on termite nests or termite mounds. In this case, the little immature is circled in green. You can't see it here. And the mound is destroyed. And this is where they kind of like to hang out, as I found on a trip to Malaysia last year. In these two last groups, a structure called the fossa spongiosa seems to be pretty important to get a hold of the prey organisms. You clearly see this in this Echecodiini, where it kind of wraps the millipede with the front and middle legs. And this fossa spongiosa sits on the tip of the tibia of the front and middle leg and consists of many what's called tendon hairs. And they also have a little bit of a secretion that they secrete, and this enhances the grip on the prey organism. Apart from prey capture, this fossa spongiosa is probably also somehow involved in just locomotion, or it could be involved in a mating context. What is a little bit surprising then, if you think, well, you have the structure that's actually pretty well adapted to getting a good grip on something, that based on my phylogenetic hypothesis of Reduviidae, this fossa spongiosa actually got lost about at least 10 times within Reduviidae. And this might make sense in some groups where I think, okay, yeah, Fimatini has these riptorial legs, so they obviously don't need a fossa spongiosa. Or another case are Triatomini, where I think, okay, they're blood feeding, so they don't really need to get a good grip on any prey insects. But then there are cases that are, in a way, a lot less evident, as for example, the Harpacterini. Harpacterini consists of, comprise more than 2,000, sorry, more than 2,200 species. That means that one in three Reduviidae actually is a Harpacterini. There are subdivided into six tribes: Apiomorini, Diaspidini, Actinolarini, Halpactorini, Raphidosomini, and Tetiini, so you know them all now. And how do they catch their prey? They don't have fossa spongiosa, as I pointed out. Well, they obviously manage pretty well, as you can see in the species of Rhinocurus that has managed to hunt down a cyanid butterfly. Then, for example, within the Tetiini, again, we don't really have a lot of observations, but we know, at least from one description dating back to the 1940s, I think, that they feed on termites. And also, if you look at them pretty closely, this is a really unusual labium for a Reduviidae. It's kind of really long. And the description indicates that they just dangle this labium into a termite nest, basically, and kind of fish the termites out. And then there's obviously something that you would kind of freely admit to being a total raptorial front leg, as, for example, in the local species of Senia, where they have really enlarged front femur. The front tibia has a lot of spines, as has the front femur, and they just wedge whatever they can get in between those. So this is pretty straightforward and easy. Then there are three groups that are together referred to as resin bugs. There is, first of all, the Apiomorini, comprising 12 recent genera with about 160 species. The most species of these genera is in the Arctic, also in the Arctic at least, genus Apiomorus. The other genera only occur in the neotropical region. Then there are the Diaspidini, consisting of only three genera with 11 species. They are restricted to the Afrotropical region, and this critter is from Madagascar. As you might be able to see, it doesn't really have a tarsus, which is kind of a little funny. I don't really know of many Reduviidae that have completely lost the tarsus. And then there are the Actinorhini, only two genera, 20 species, and they're restricted to Southeast Asia. If you take a bit closer look at the image of this type specimen in the collection in Stockholm, you see there's all these black little blobs on the front tibia, and this is actually resin, and this is also documented in this illustration reconstruction of a fossil genus of Apuremurus, in which the author indicates that the assassin bug had actually its front legs covered with resin. A little bit more specifically, we know that in Actinorhinae, the adults and immatures apply resin of Pinus or Agathis, that's an Araucariaceae, to their front legs and capture prey. That's pretty well established, and there are several observations on that. Then we do know, even though the evidence is a little less clear-cut maybe, that also Diaspidinae cover their anterior tibia with resin for the purpose of capturing prey. And then the situation becomes a little bit more complex within the Apuremurinae, where we can know that four species, all these four genera, are monotypic, apply resin to front leg and capture prey. Here we only have data for the adults. Then for Heniartos, there is one observation that they actually produce sticky secretions themselves, so they would be kind of independent of external sticky secretions or resins. And then there's the genus Apuremurus, where it looks like as if only the female would actually collect sticky plant secretions or resins. And we're going to be hearing quite a bit more about it in just a second. Then let's move into... Do I have to scream like that? Okay, well, I keep screaming then.
There's no microphone.
Okay, that's because I'm really going, Okay, then let's move into the nominal tribe, the Harpactrinae. There we know that species of the genus Celus produce their own sticky secretion, pretty similar to what I just told you about for the genus Heniartus within the Apuremurinae. And I'm going to be talking about this in just a second as well. Then there's, for example, Rhinocoris, where it looks like, and this is observations I made back in Europe a while ago, that different species would preferably deposit eggs on sticky plants, as for example, different species of cistus. And then an observation that goes back to my diploma thesis work in southern Brazil, there I found that species of Cosmoclopius wouldn't only deposit their eggs on sticky plants, as for example, certain species of Eupatorium, but that the first instar nymphs would then walk around those sticky plants pretty well. They don't get stuck or anything, but then feed on little other insects that actually got stuck to the trichomes of the Eupatorium. And then finally, another observation that I made in Malaysia last year. This is an egg badge of another nominal tribe, Harpactrinae, of the genus Vespius. And I found that they deposit their egg badges really close to resin flows. Actually, in this case, it looks pretty damn close to me because, I mean, a little bit further, and that would have been it. And what I also found were that there were exuvia of first and instar nymphs just cluttered around this resin flow, indicating that the immatures actually stay on that resin for quite a while. So in the long term, what I would like to figure out is how the evolution of the use of exogenous sticky secretion looks like, and how the evolution of endogenous sticky secretions in assassin bugs, and more specifically, how Harpactrinae looks like. What we obviously need in order to do that is a lot of natural history data, and this is a problem. And on the other hand, we obviously need a phylogeny of Harpactrinae. I've been just giving you two little case study impressions, one on Celus and one on genus Apuremurus. And I'll let you give you a little bit of background on where we are at with the phylogeny of Harpactrinae, and then I'll be attempting a first and very crude interpretation based on the currently available data. So back to the genus Celus. There are glandular units scattered all over the front and middle legs in this critter, and this is these little roundish, or as I call them, bell-shaped structures that you see here. Here you see them in a close-up. And they're really very different from just normal dermal glands, as you would have them in any other assassin bug, too, and many other true bugs as well. They release a sticky secretion through these pores, and the secretion then spreads over the surface of the integument and gets stuck in these really funny shaped hairs. And then the assassin bug basically just holds its legs up. You can see that it looks kind of wet, and this is actually the secretion. Then you introduce a housefly into the container, and the assassin bug just goes junk. And the fly gets stuck maybe just for a fraction of a second, basically, but it's obviously enough for the assassin bug to actually grab the fly and kill it. Okay, but what about the immatures? And I'm asking this because the first instar immatures actually do not have those glands, so there's a problem. The first instars hatch from these egg batches that are covered with a sticky secretion. And then in the next step, they collect the sticky secretion from this egg mass and basically smear it all over themselves, transfer glue to the other legs, and then start catching prey. And this is what this looks like in a little not very great movie, but you can see the behavior. So this is the egg mass, basically, and there's still first instars hatching, and there's a little older immature that starts tapping the egg mass and scrapes the secretion off and smears it all over itself. Okay. Okay. So the question obviously is, where do these secretions come from that cover the egg mass? Since there weren't any exogenous sticky secretions in a container with the female, I thought, well, they're probably derived from the female. And this is why I dissected the female and found there are two glandular systems present around the female internal genitalia. One of them is suprarectal glands. They've been known for hypertrichy for a pretty long time. And then I found a second, so far undescribed, gland. The so-called lateral glands. I don't know which of the two glands actually is responsible for the secretion, but I'll hopefully find out at some point. In any case, in a way, this is a pretty cool case, I think, of maternal care, where a sticky secretion is produced by the mother and then deposited on the egg mass is used by the first instar nymph to catch its first meal. Okay, what happens then? First instar nymphs don't have any glands, and then there are two things that happen throughout the immature stages. One is the nymph hatches and it would just go back to its exuvia and collect a sticky secretion from the exuvia and just smear it all over itself again, basically. The other thing that happens is that you actually start finding the gland sacculi that I described for the adults. So there's an increase in the number of the pores. I only looked at the pores from the outside, basically, but they correspond to the actual glands on the inside. So I found four in the second instar and then 10, 13, and 18. So that means there's an increasing capability to produce the own secretion, and it also means that there's an increasing independence from exogenous sticky substances. Okay. So that much for the genus Celus. Then I'm moving to the bee killer assassin bugs. Those don't have any sticky glands of the Celus type, and also they don't have any subrectal glands or lateral glands. But again, the egg batch is covered with a sticky secretion. Therefore, the question, where do those secretions come from? And it's pretty interesting. Around our area, for example, local species, the females collect resin from, for example, encilia, the brittle bush. In southern Brazil, again, they were using the certain species of Eupatorium that's terribly sticky. And the females then would transfer the sticky secretion to the abdominal venter. And the females are species of Epiermes are sexually endomorphic. Only the females have a really dense cover of ceti on its abdominal venter. And then when they're laying eggs, they would scrape off the secretion with what's called a metatibial comb, this little comb-like structure on the posterior surface of the metatibia, and then smear that secretion again all over the egg mass. What then happens is pretty much exactly the same thing as what I described to you for Celus. The first instars hatch, they make themselves sticky, and they start catching prey. Well, I'm cheating here, this is the third or fourth instar. And then when they grow up, they're exactly doing the same thing as Celus does. They would mold and use the sticky secretion from the exuvia to make themselves sticky. As I mentioned before, there are no sticky glands of the Celus type in Apiomers. But just to make things a little bit more complicated, I pretty recently stumbled over a publication by Bart, who described a pretty unusual type of glands in Apiomers. And we had a little trouble finding and documenting these glands. Here you see the broken off bases of ceti, and then in between you see these dark little tubules. And those are actually, again, glandular units. And what we also found is that those nanar units are, especially in those areas that are in contact with the collected resin. We don't have any idea really what the function of those could be, but we're kind of speculating in a way that it could have something to do with kind of slowing down the polymerization of those resins, because in nature they just dry up, that's it. Okay, the question then is, the sticky behavior in the first instars of cetals and apurimers, is it homologous or convergent? In order to be able to answer the question, you obviously need a phylogeny. There are two competing hypotheses out there, one by Davis on the left and one by myself on the right. Davis' hypothesis shows that the resin bugs are monophyletic and that the Halpactorini, that would include Coelus, are nested among the other tribes. It seems as if sticky affinities, to call it that, for the moment, are homologous in the resin bugs, but most likely convergent in Halpactorini. If you look at my phylogeny, it looks a little different. Their resin bugs are paraphyletic. The Actinodorini form a sister group to all remaining Halpactorini. The second branch are the Apiomorini, and then we have one clade that contains Diaspidini, Tegiini, and Halpactorini. And this is, for example, supported by pretarsal structures and the subarachnoid gland that I mentioned before. And while I was kind of pleased that our very, very preliminary molecular data set seems to also be supporting that result. Again, Diaspidini, Halpactorini group together, and Apiomorini, the sister group. Okay, just to summarize what we know so far, or I believe we probably do know, there are Actinodorini, Diaspidini, and certain groups of Apiomorini are known to apply resin to the front legs. Then there are at least two instances, one in Haniartus, one in Coelus, in which we know that endogenous sticky secretions are produced. Then there's a special case of apurimers where it looks like as if only the female would be collecting resin. And then there are at least certain cases of raw affinity to sticky substances, like depositing eggs on sticky plants, for example. So this phylogeny, together with these observations, kind of insinuates that sticky affinities might actually have been already present at the base of the Halpactorini. And it could also mean that the behavior seen in Coelus and apurimers is potentially homologous. What we obviously need is more biological data and a lot more systematic data. And with this, I would like to thank a number of people and you.
We have time for one question.
Are there any structures on the insect that allow them to clean those, like the thing of Coelus from REI? Because I've seen them junk all over their legs. I just kind of curious.
That's a huge problem. Well, I mean, obviously, the cleaning structure that most true bugs have is this little 4-tibia comb on the anterior surface of the tibia when you kind of think the leg stretched out like that. And that part is actually, it's covered with resin, so there's no way they can use that, basically. So, no, I don't know how it could potentially work. I just know they're not always walking around totally dirty, but they don't really have any obvious structures that would help them to get rid of that stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Initial, her real initial is E, and I even know what it stands for. So I just wanted you to know that, Jane, and I want everybody else to know that I may be stupid, but I'm not ignorant. There are, as of course you know, a lot of color pairs, what one might call color pairs in Heteropteran, probably in other groups as well. And by that I mean two species that are not necessarily related, and in fact may be very distantly related, that are of the same bright color and sometimes of the same or similar patterning, as in this case. Many of these, at least in the Heteroptera, consist of a potential prey species, a herbivore, and a potential predator. But it's not always clear that the predator does in fact prey upon the herbivore species that looks like it. Nevertheless, many of these species are sympatric, and there are also other kinds of pairs, a herbivore-herbivore pair.
Part of this process for me is also looking for some input, either before or after the show, on how you think this technology might be useful.
Spacebar.
Well, this might be an older version, but that's okay. So I'll give some examples. The third item here, BRIC technology, stands for bi-rotational image capture. What we found was if you take images just rotating the sample, that's kind of one type of 3D effect. Another is to rotate the optics around the sample. But what really seems to work is rotating both in opposite directions. And we'll have an example of that. It's almost as if you're doing a spacewalk around your sample. We'll see that in a second. And then some of the challenges that we see for imaging in 3D, both in the way you mount samples. I mean, we had never really taken a close look at that prior to, you know, a year ago, but now we're really taking a close look at actually how you mount your samples. They don't really lend themselves to 3D imaging, typically, but we'll see. So this, the whole thing began, I spent 3 years at NASA as the chairman of their science advisory group down in Huntsville, Alabama, and we were looking at macromolecular crystals that we were growing on board the space station and on board the orbiter. And the people, you know, terra firma on Earth, wanted to get a better view of those crystals being grown in space. And they didn't want a 2D image of those. They wanted to see a 3D image of a 5 to 50 micron crystal. So that's where we started with this project. Then, after crystallography, we started to take a look at the other natural sciences. You know, maybe mammalogists would be able to use it to look at things in a different way.